Blog Talk Radio.
Good evening, everybody. This is the Matt Kwasaborski Show, calling you live and direct from Prague, Czech Republic, the heart of Central Europe, on a beautiful yet last gasp of fall day here on the 27th of October, 2017. We're going to talk a little bit about today what's going on in the world, also the United States, and of course, looking at American sports or the NFL leading into week 7 as we're almost at the halfway point of the season. But first, before we go, I'd like to thank all of my loyal listeners. I'd like to thank Blog Talk Radio for being created and for Al Gore for inventing the internet. So I really do appreciate people who are listening to the show either live or on the podcast downloaded. I'm still trying to get back into the swing of things to do these podcasts. This is the first time in about 4 years that I'm trying to make it at least a weekly part of my ritual, as I usually enjoy doing them. I did them, like I said, weekly for about 3 years, but haven't been doing it consistently or at all in the last 3.5 years. So I'm glad to be back, trying to, again, get into a rhythm, establish a consistency, as well as train myself to speak better in the public forums. The last couple of weeks, we've talked about what's going on in the world, and I think some things of the way the world is shifting in its dynamics. I notice it here a lot living in the Czech Republic, and there's some things happening back home in my home country, the United States of America, when it comes to foreign policy and sort of its interests in transatlantic relationships, which seem to be pretty much getting beat down a little bit as I start to see certain countries here sort of take some shifts either back towards Russia, or you see their spheres of influence, Russia expanding their spheres of influence through elections, through financing certain public parties or political parties that have generally resulted in election results, not only here in the Czech Republic, but also in neighboring Austria, who elected a young populist leader on the 15th of October, Sebastian Kurz, who becomes the youngest leader of a head of state at 31 years old. And we talked about the Czech elections here, how two of the four most popular parties gaining the most votes tend to have not an anti-EU, but want to see more of a nationalistic approach, closing borders, as well as less influence within more influence coming from the East than there is from the West. So that's what we're going to talk about a little bit. The populism is just growing, and trying to study what exactly populism is, what populism means, and why is the world turning that way. And I think you just see, again, the last 27 years since the fall of communism, you see that the way the world is shifting is sort of ending that world. The post-Soviet Union world is sort of ending. And it seems to be that the powers of the world really want to have their say of the spheres of influence, and the powers that we all know today, obviously the United States, which is sort of the Western world. We have Russia, which is sort of central world, and we have China in the East. And you see some amazing things developing amongst the leaders and the way the world is shifting today. If you look at this part of the world, we talked about the Czech elections last week as the populist party with no real platform called ANO or YES or Citizens for a Disfranchised Movement. Not a party was elected to a large majority here with over 30% of the votes. Coming in second was the traditionally conservative yet free market party called ODS. Falling in third place was the centrist party called the Czech Pirates, who never have held any sort of parliamentary seats until this year. Will have a major say. And then we have the far right-wing nationalistic SPD. I'm not sure what they stand for or headed, but it's very anti-immigration, very anti-EU, and in favor of nationalizing even the state media to really have the state control of influence and tools of propaganda, because they see how powerful the media can be in influencing voters. And in fact, the Czech Republic's new leading party, ANO, their leader, Andrej Babiš, owns majority of the Czech daily newspapers. He owns large agricultural firms, and he's a businessman. He's the second richest businessman in the Czech Republic, and no one really seems to care how he got rich, why he's rich here. He's just rich, and we all want to be like him, so we're going to vote for him because he's going to run our country like a business, And if he runs his country like he does his businesses, that means maybe we all have a chance to get rich instead of him getting rich. Same thing is happening across the part of the world. They want a strong man leader. It doesn't matter what their ethics are anymore. It doesn't matter if they have any morals. It doesn't matter what they stand for, as long as they stand for making more money. If they line their own pockets, maybe they'll help me line my pockets. If they say they're going to run this country like a business, it must mean that we're going to be successful, even though he's under investigation by the Czech National Police for the embezzlement of EU funding. What happens here in Europe is that the European Union funds several countries or large businesses in certain countries for subsidies, gives them some sort of loans, which they pay out to help their businesses get on track or to be modernized, because these individual countries don't seem to have the means to do it by themselves. So therefore, they seek federal assistance. It's like if you're an American and you're a company that looking for business loans or some sort of subsidies. Farmers oftentimes get subsidies from the federal government. You see it here in Europe through the EU. And now that these countries, such as the Czech Republic, are getting a little bit more rich, they're electing people that don't want to necessarily be with the EU, and they fail to realize that their EU, while he says he's pro-European, on one hand, has also criticized the European Union for treating the countries of the Visegrad, which would be the Czech Republic, Slovak, Hungary, as miniature nations, not really having that much influence, or as a strong nations. And I can understand these countries taking offense to that, but that doesn't necessarily mean that they should be leaving or thinking about leaving the EU anytime soon. Look, I'm not a real fan of the EU as much as I am of NATO, but I do think that the EU needs to be reformed. However, we'll go back to the adage, and one thing in the economic courses that the Fund for American Studies, and this is, and by the way, this podcast does not reflect their opinions, is the idea that, you know, once you stop trading, basically soldiers will cross borders. Once goods stop crossing borders, soldiers will. Give that quote is given to the longtime French philosopher, economist Bastiat. Even though you can't really historically trace it back to him, he's been given credit over time for that statement. And that's what happened until after World War II, with the creation of the European Commission, the coal and steel treaty between France and Germany. France and Germany had a long history of going to battle with each other. But since World War II, they have not gone to battle with each other. In fact, Europe, outside of the Balkan region and now Ukraine, has really experienced the most peaceful time ever in the history of Europe, due to the fact of the creation of trading between nations. I think the EU has been over-regulating certain aspects of industry, such as if you're an EU nation, you can only serve a certain kind of bananas, or the certain shape of the banana can only be sold. I think that's a little overstepping its bounds. But also, the EU has taken on this persona of these elites that cannot be touched. I do agree upon that. There's immunity for the European Parliament members. There's a lot of different benefits that these members get that I think is a little bit one-sided. And the EU is looking at being an ultra-super state or a superpower in terms of what the Soviet Union is trying to exert its influence and too much of its power over different European nations, and European nations are rebelling against that. It's almost like if different states started rebelling against the mandates of the federal government and they wanted to start to think about breaking away. And that's what you see. Brexit isn't exactly the same, because while the Great Britain was integrated into the EU, it still wasn't part of the Schengen zone, which means you needed you would get a stamp in your passport if you traveled there. It also was not on the euro because the pound was much stronger, one of the reasons. And it always seemed itself a little bit distant, and it now wants to let the continent of Europe sort of to break away. It would be the equivalent in a way if like Alaska broke away from the United States and said, let the people down there, the continent, rule themselves, and we'll just take care of ourselves, and we'll have limits, and we'll create trade deals with each individual state instead of the United States federal government. And that's a little bit in a nutshell what Brexit is. Of course, it's a lot deeper than that. But that's sort of the idea here, is that you have the countries are beginning to sort of rebel against the EU, rebel against their mandates and their strict policies, especially when it comes not only to economics, but to law and also towards immigration policies. In fact, a lot of the countries over here, including Czech Republic, Hungary, Slovakia, and Poland, have sort of rejected the EU mandate of how many refugees or migrants have been they, that they can take in. And that's why you see an influx of migrants into Germany and Austria. And one of the reasons why Austria elected a populist party who campaigned on anti-immigration or immigration reform is because they think there's too many immigrants coming in and they're really not sure what to do with these immigrants or what should be done with them if they can really be integrated into society. European populists, and maybe sort of American populists, do not believe in multiculturalism. The fact that these different cultures cannot be integrated into society, that the Muslims will always have a different view of the societies they live in than the Christians do. I think that's sort of I want to say an ignorant way to look at things because, you know, there's so many successful stories of people, of groups of people from Muslim nations integrating into the West, becoming citizens, learning the language, obeying the laws, setting up businesses, and contributing to societies. And I think that's, of course, there's always going to be these sense of people who want to come and destroy the way of life. There's this big, huge fear of the Islamization of not only Europe, but of the United States. And in fact, if you are a fan of the Donald Trump movement, not necessarily Donald Trump himself, but you think that the previous globalist regimes were in fact inviting Muslims coming into the United States and making the United States more of an Islamic state over time. And it goes back to President Obama, whose middle name is Hussein. These are a wide variety of controversial and conspiracy theories, but there is these people out there that think this, and this kind of thinking has infected now into the politics. I'm not saying that they're completely wrong because I do believe that there's a certain groups, and we've seen the attacks over in Europe, in Paris, especially in Belgium, in London, in Manchester. You know, we see these attacks that by pro-Islamists who want to turn these different countries or shake fear within society and to promote the Wahhabism way of life to these different societies by attacking people and murdering people, especially during popular cultural Western events such as plays, musicals, concerts, football matches, or through modes of transportation in airports and train stations. I think that fear does exist, but I do not think it prevalates every single Muslim out there. I do think that the less chance that the governments or the less opportunities that ruling governments have in sort of reaching out to these different communities and trying to get their sense of integration and how much they really want to integrate, i.e. getting immigration status, not just for welfare handouts, especially in Western EU countries, but learning languages, trying to get jobs, trying to contribute to society and going along with the laws of the land has to be made an effort. Because if not, then the people that did immigrate, who did not want to stay in the supposed Muslim paradise of ISIS or the caliphate that was recently destroyed, these people did not want to stay here. They wanted to come to the West where they deemed that society was safer, that their governments weren't out to murder them in the streets. And I think what you see now is a sharp backlash against that within the populist votes, but also going back to my thought that the governments have to make some sort of effort, because if not, if you isolate these sort of groups, ignore them and put them into different camps or give them certain areas where they can just live on their own, I think that's then you do have the danger of that. Sure, there's examples, especially in Britain, where you have British citizens who have either were born in the UK or have immigrated, who have become hostile towards the British government and is trying to create a sense of jihad within those movements and to attack. I just don't think that's realistic. I don't think that Europe will be Islamicized in any time soon unless there's a major movement that we don't know about that's, you know, weapons are being shipped, you know, concealed through containers, and that the EU people and the police, the EU border protection, are not monitoring these sort of weapons and caches coming in, then maybe there's going to be some sort of huge attack. But I really don't see that happening anytime soon, where it's a coordinated attack throughout the continent of Europe. So getting back to the point, though, populists were who had once said that the United the economy, the global economy, was the reason to blame for the financial crisis. That sort of is true. I do believe that, but I also believe, but they have not been able to campaign on that rhetoric. What they have been able to campaign on, leading towards these towards the most recent elections, is the immigration policies. The reason that they can't really harp on the financial crisis is because these countries, the EU especially, and especially here in the Czech Republic, and even in Hungary to a certain extent, the economies have been slowly improving. The unemployment population here in Prague is around 2%. If you go throughout the country, the unemployment, I don't know the rate, it was at 10%, has dropped under that. And you see the slow improvements because that it is a true market economy. True market economies are cyclical. Yes, what happened in 2008, spreading through 2012, especially here in Europe, was disastrous. And it was because of greedy capitalists. It was because people were taking advantage of other people and just looking out for their bottom line and for their pockets. But hey, you know what? You have rich businessmen now in power. They know how to make money. So now that they're in power, maybe they'll have a sense to show you how to make more money without being greedy and not caring about the lives of others. In the sense that, you know, they're the ones that have been elected in power, especially here in Czech Republic, also in the United States, in that they represent a different way to also see the world. And maybe in their worldview, you will become a richer person. I think that's very naive for people to think. You also see a shift here in the influence. For example, the German president Steinmeier, who was the former foreign minister, was recently elected president, who has sort of always been someone who leaned towards the left within his political views, and has been seen wanting to make relations with Russia much stronger than they have been. And he said the most major roadblock is the idea of what's happening in Ukraine. The fact that that's pretty much the only major roadblock that we have left to basically normalizing relations with Russia again. Again, the country of Ukraine, a country where I've spent a large majority of my time from, especially in the years 2015, 2016, has basically is being seen as, well, you know what, maybe that Russia should exert more control over it. If we normalize relations with Russia, maybe we can get the Ukrainians to sort of back off and accept the fact that they are the first European country since World War II to have their land invaded and annexed, as Crimea was annexed in 2014. By Russia, and it seems to think, well, you know what, maybe Russia isn't so bad. Maybe we can start getting back into their markets. And the fact that once we get back into the Russian market, maybe the economy will improve. So this is sort of the idea of what's happening. Tomorrow is the observation of the 199th year of the creation of Czechoslovakia. Tomorrow, the Czechs and the Slovaks, who supported the nation of Czechoslovakia and giving them true statehood, they celebrate 99 years tomorrow on October the 28th here in Prague. The president, Zeman, who is very pro-Russian in his viewpoints, considers himself a friend of Putin, who was a former member of the Communist Party, is one of the people that they go and they sort of on this day sort of give awards out to influential leaders, not only in the Czech Republic, but also throughout Europe. And the one person from Germany that President Zeman is going to be declared to be given this medal is Gerhard Schröder, the former Chancellor of Germany before Angela Merkel. Schröder has been named Chairman of the Board of Gazprom, which is the, let's see, it is, I believe he is the German Chancellor from 98 to 95. He is now the Chairman of the Russian Gas Company of, I believe it's Gazprom. This means that he has very, very close relations with the Russian government, with Vladimir Putin himself. It's also considered the biggest oil company in the world. And basically, he's trying to, you know, he's being accused of trying to increase Germany's dependence on Russia through these, Rosneft is the name of the oil producer of Russia. It's the biggest one in the world. And basically, this country, or this company, Rosneft, has been under severe economic sanctions since Russia invaded Ukraine and annexed its land back in 2014. And Schrader will be honored tomorrow by President Zeman. And the reason being is that they want to honor someone who's been a leader throughout European affairs. Germany has often had a very schizophrenic relation with Russia, and that has to dates back historically, but especially since Germany was partitioned after World War II into East and West Germany. The point being is that you see the world now a little bit here in Europe. You see Viktor Orban. Now you see the idea of the Czechs electing Andrei Babiš, who doesn't seem to have any sort of criticism towards Russia. And now you see that the president who seems to really care about Russia is going to give a Medal of Honor to Gerhard Schroeder, the German ex-chancellor, the chairman of Rosneft, of a Russian gas company, and trying to normalize relations. Meanwhile, in the United States, interesting thing is that going back to Russia is that in spring or summer, Congress passed a new level of sanctions against Russia due to their electronic interference or their interference into our elections. Now, it could have been done electronically. It could have been done other ways, mostly through the internet. And these sanctions were handed down, and President Trump, someone who has never criticized Russia or its president, Putin, reluctantly signed the bill. However, you know, when they signed the bill, these laws were never implemented. In fact, the sanctions were never even implemented. And when people were starting to press the White House on the reason why, they said, well, the State Department was still reviewing it. Well, it comes out yesterday that the State Department just decided to abolish the office that monitors and imposes sanctions. What that means for the sanctions that are currently on Russia by the United States, or on Iran for that matter, is a matter of question. But the fact that the sanctions department was completely obliterated by the Trump administration really goes to show you again another way for Trump to begin normalizing relations with Russia. You see the fact that, and the reason being is that President, one of the reasons, besides speculation, and the speculation obviously is that Trump is indebted heavily to the Russian government after his fifth bankruptcy as a wonderful rich businessman in the tune of, I've heard, around $63 billion. But that's really not proven because Trump won't release his tax. The trail of money, especially the way Russians do business, is very hard to trace. But the fact is that Trump does believe in the same worldview as Putin, that there should not be this interdependence on these international NATO, such as the EU, that each nation should have their own, each superpower or regional power, if you will, should be able to exert its own influence within its own region, and other countries should stay out of it. What I would say to the days when we had czars and kings, basically that would be the pre-World War I days where, you know, there were kingdoms and not democratic states. And I think that's one way you see a lot of the movements of the Trump administration to, in ways sort of break down the deconstruct the United States as it is in existence, by constantly attacking the media, the judicial system, and Trump goes on Twitter oftentimes and criticizes fellow Republicans and fellow Democrats, anyone that dares to criticize our leader, that he goes after them and tries to bully them. But also, you go back to the campaign and you can see him praising all these leaders that were pretty much dictators or kings, including saying that even after he was elected, it would be an honor to meet the North Korean leader, Kim Jong-un. So that goes to show you the way Trump sees the world. And it's not something that's surprising. When you elect people that are rich businessmen, remember, these people, whether you're Andrei Babiš, Donald Trump, anyone else that's a businessman in power, even Rex Tillerson, the Secretary of State, the longtime CEO of Exxon, when they're used to walking into their boardrooms, and they're used to saying, this is what I want done, and this is when it should be done, and get it done. No questions asked, no criticisms, no questions. Just find a way to get it done. And that's what's happening in the governments, and that's what's going to start happening here in the Czech Republic. You know, Babiš is going to go into parliament and start demanding that laws be passed because he's the one elected by the people. Trump does the same thing. He doesn't really say it, but he's like, I'm the one elected by the people. Well, his elected by the people, therefore those senators or congress people or people of the house who are not passing his bills or his ideas, they're in fact in rebellion against the president and the people. And that's what you're going to see heading into the elections of 2018. Well, I spent about 25 minutes on there, and I probably should do a separate show on my world views as well as what's happening in the United States and the western part of the world, is that we're going to head into a period of nationalism, isolationism in a sense, and the slow breakdown of international coalitions. I don't think you'll see the dissolution of the EU, but I think you'll see countries like Georgia, Ukraine, and Moldova in this part of the world fall more under the influence of Russia over time. In Moldova, it's already happening. In Georgia, it's already slowly happening. And Ukraine is still in this sort of schizophrenic period trying to figure out which way it's going to lean, if it's going to become more part of Europe. But I think now if you see countries like Germany, especially Germany, start normalizing relations with Russia, Ukraine's not going to have much support. And you have not heard much in the words of Ukraine coming out of the United States recently, except for the uranium deals that the RNC is now accusing the DNC of issuing with between Ukraine and Russia. And also apparently there's a lot of pro-Sputnik journalists who used to be for Breitbart, Lee Stranahan, who has a radio show and goes on TV. He really wants to investigate how the Ukrainians tried to influence the elections on the DNC side, much like a lot of people think the Russians tried to influence the American elections on the Republican side. And I really think that just goes to show you for even in that the United States is just that we're not capable of thinking on our own feet as Americans anymore and making our own decisions, that we're being subverted by some super secret shadowy entity that's the one that's really influencing the things that are happening. It's a very pro-Soviet way. Everything that was blamed upon the Soviet Union collapsing was a CIA plot. It wasn't the people of the land. There's no way the people of the Soviet Union will want to rebel against the Soviet Union. It was a CIA plot. Furthermore, the elections in Russia to get Boris Yeltsin elected, it was a CIA plot. There's no way the Russians in their right mind would want to vote for someone that's a democratic and free nation. And what you're seeing in the United States now is there's no way that the United States, they're trying to say that the secret Russians on the Republican side, these secret Ukrainian hackers on the Democratic side, were the ones influencing our minds, and that's, you know, there's no way we would absolutely be able to vote on our own free will, that we're being, that there's some sort of deep state out there, you know, going against the will of the people. In fact, actually, the United States theory on the nationalistic Trump side of this deep state extend to the fact that it would be the equivalent of the Russians always blaming the CIA on something. These Trump people who are trying to deconstruct the United States first into a more, I'd say, more dictatorial nation are blaming this deep state, which would also include the CIA. So these are just interesting things that are happening, that the individual person and individuality and individual freedoms are under attack by saying, you know, we're not strong enough to think on our own free minds, and there's no way we would, you know, there's no way that the true way people want the world to live in the United States can really happen because the deep state is holding us back, and vice versa. The only way the Soviet Union collapsed is because of the interference of the CIA or also the United States deep state. And that's kind of a shame the way it is. You know, when they talk about the Ukrainian Maidan, you know, Putin was very fast to understand and think it was a CIA plot, because there's no way the Ukrainians would want to break away from their brother nation of Russia. And in fact, the Ukrainian was called Little Russia for so long and was never really seen or as the little brother of Russia. And there's no way that would ever happen. Even in a family dynamic, you see the little brothers or the brothers wanting to break away from the parents and go on their own and be independent. It's just natural. It even happened under communism. The sons and daughters grew up, they left the house, they created their own families. It's just a natural thing to happen. There's only 16 minutes left in this podcast, and I really went on a tangent there. But the worldview is basically you see spheres of influence starting to really to take shape, I think. But liberal democracy, the idea of international cooperation, is not on its last legs, but I think it's getting slowly and slowly driven away. I do think, you know, talking to certain civil servants in various nations in the United States and the Czech Republic, that they feel it's their job to stay and make sure that through policies that they're trying to enact to show how they are against the constitutions of these governments. And the last thing I'll say about the constitutions of Ukraine and Egypt were so strong in that you had coups when the leaders started to try to manipulate those constitutions when rebellion started to happen. It happened in Egypt under Mubarak, then it happened under Morsi, even though the military took control of the country, al-Sisi was still in power. But in Ukraine, when Yanukovych started manipulating the constitution that existed after 1991, you saw the people begin to stage demonstrations. Was it a revolution? In a sense, you know, I would categorize it as the Euromaidan or the Revolution of Dignity, as Ukrainians call it. So yes, it was a revolution, but the leader chose to fled. The leader didn't choose to stay behind and face the music, or, you know, which would have been arrested and put on trial. I don't blame him for fleeing, but Morsi in Egypt didn't have a chance to do that. And the supposed strongest democratic constitution in the world is the United States. And hopefully, if things tend to keep spiraling downwards and what we're traditionally used to in the United States to a more dictatorial, totalitarian, authoritative regime, that the Constitution will be able to uphold the standards and protect the freedom of the people. So let's look at real quick the NFL Week 7. Didn't go into last week in my picks. Again, what I'm trying to show you is how to pick against the spreads. To understand how point systems work, and real fast, if your team is a favorite, the Las Vegas will set the odds, or some magical entity will set the odds. For example, last night, the Thursday night game, the Miami Dolphins went into the Baltimore Ravens. The Baltimore Ravens were giving a line of -3, which means they were favored by 3 points. And that means if you bet Baltimore, they had to win by more than 3 points, or if you bet Miami, that Miami had to either win the game or you thought they would lose by less than 3 points. Baltimore was a -3. Well, they obliterated the Dolphins 40-0. So if you bet Baltimore, they obviously scored more than beat Miami by more than 3 points. And if you chose Miami, you obviously lost by more than 3 points. So Baltimore wins. Last week, I went 6-6-2. In the last 2 weeks, I have not lost any money if I bet money. And that's pretty much, you start to see the trend going a little bit upward. There were some surprises last week, but again, usually if I did these things, and I usually bet money, and sometimes I do, I usually don't start the week 10 because then I feel like I have a hand on the league of what's really happening. So therefore, I can say I'm almost approaching that sort of there as we head into week 8 of the NFL season. I thought it was week 7. The Eagles are 6-1, which means week 8. Yeah, this will be the 8th week of the season. Sorry, it's a Polish brain. Good thing I don't bet too much money. So anyway, just wanted to go through the games this week before we turn it over. 6-6-2. And no one really bets every game. It's not a law to bet every game if you're going to bet money. You just want to choose the games you're really confident in. So therefore, it'll be only, and for the season, I'm only three games under breaking even, which means if I bet one check ground, one U.S. dollar, I would be, I would be owing someone those actual three check crowns or three U.S. dollars or hundreds or thousands of check crowns, dollars, whatever. So let's go into the picks real fast. Baltimore over Miami. I did choose Baltimore last night. You can always say, of course, it's easy for you to pick. I do the picks before sitting down to the podcast. I just didn't do the podcast before the game. So therefore, the last Thursday night games, I'm 4-0 in, so that's good. Cleveland, oh my God, the 0-7 Cleveland Browns going to London to play the Minnesota Vikings. Minnesota's favored by 9.5 points. The only reason I'm tempted to take Cleveland in this game with the points not to win is the fact that they're in a neutral site. They're not going to Miami's hometown, and they're getting out of not only the highly, highly negative charge coming from Cleveland media. The national media has been so on Cleveland. I think they get out, and I think they do cover against Minnesota, who's, you know, Cleveland's offense, defense is not that terrible, and Minnesota still has their third string quarterback in there. So I'm going to choose the Cleveland Browns in London, in a neutral site, and getting out of the negative media attention they're getting not only from Cleveland and Ohio, but the whole United States. The Bears go into, there is 10 minutes left, 2.5 minutes to go. The Bears go into the New Orleans Saints. The Saints are favored by 9. Chicago last week won a game by only passing the ball 7 times. And they beat Carolina at home. I chose Chicago last week, but they beat Carolina with a stalwart defense. And also the fact they only passed the ball 7 times. That was the formula the Carolina Panthers used against the Eagles in the NFC Championship game many moons ago. But it seemed to work. They go into the Saints. The Saints offense is clicking on all cylinders right now. They went into Green Bay last week in the shocking upset of the Green Bay Packers. I thought the Packers would win that game, but I took the Saints. I took Green Bay with the points because Noah was favored by 4 points. New Orleans was favored by 4 last week. They outscored Green Bay by 9. They should be able to beat Chicago at home by more than 9, so take the Saints. And the Saints are becoming the dark horse contender in not only in the AFC, the NFC South, but the NFC in general. Atlanta Falcons, who have been beaten at home by the Buffalo Bills and the Miami Dolphins, in another surprising loss last week, go into the New York Jets, who are favored by 4.5 points. I don't think the Jets are a bad team. They lost to New England 24-17 at home, and they lose to Miami at home last week 31-28. I chose the Jets, but Miami is favored by 3 points. I don't get it. I think the Jets at one point they're playing New England for the division lead. They're not as bad as this. And Atlanta, I think this is a chance for the Falcons to right the ship, but I think the Jets are going to cover the points. Atlanta may win the game, but the Jets getting 4.5 at home against a bad, an inconsistent, if not bad, Atlanta team right now, no way I would take the Jets all the way. Carolina Panthers, fresh off losses to the Eagles at home and Chicago on the road, go into Tampa Bay. Tampa Bay is favored by 2 points. This is a huge divisional game for both teams. Tampa Bay is struggling. Carolina is struggling. And I think Carolina is struggling because of Cam Newton took a nasty hit towards the end of the Eagles game and did not look at all at right last week or interested. I think he has a chance to heal. Tampa Bay went on the road and lost to Arizona 38-33, and they lost to Buffalo last week on a last-second field goal in overtime, 30-27 last-second field goal. I'm going to take the Panthers here. I'm going to take them with the points, so I think that Tampa Bay may win the game, but they will only win by a point or so. San Francisco, who has been 5-2 against the spread, even though they're 0-7, go into the red-hot Philadelphia Eagles. Eagles are favored by 13 in this game. The issue about this game is that they're calling for massive storms on the East Coast, which rain can always play a funny factor into these games, but the weather should be humid. I think the Eagles will win this game. I think they'll win it outright, and I think they'll cover it all the way. In fact, they're in my survivor pool this week, and I think this is the last time I would choose the Eagles in a survivor pool. With that said, San Francisco will somehow upset the game 7-3 or something like that. And Eagles have some concerns coming off that Monday night wonderful win over the Washington Deadskins, as we can call them now, not the Redskins, but the Deadskins. Eagles came out and answered the bell. I took Washington with points, and considering they're giving 5.5 points last week, or 4.5 going into the game, I think it was 5 was the line. It doesn't matter. Eagles win by 10. I'm always glad to lose those picks when the Eagles win the game. But therefore, I think the Eagles can cover the 13 points. I think San Francisco got obliterated at home. Just the Eagles are red hot right now, and Carson Wentz really defined himself as, I don't want to say like the young, he's definitely the young and upcoming star of the league, but he's also in the MVP race. He single-handedly willed the Eagles to win with some crazy abilities on the running and the passing games and his ability not to give up. You see him, the Eagles struggled in the first quarter, but he never gave up. The Skins were going to play that game tough, and they did. And I said the only reason the Skins probably would lose that game was because they're injured and they're banged up. And it showed. I mean, it just showed at the various positions the Eagles were able to wear them down and terrorizing their offensive line. The Skins quarterback had a great game statistically, but really was under pressure a lot of times, especially on third downs. But anyway, Eagles will cover this. Oakland goes into Buffalo. Buffalo is favored by 2.5 points. I think Oakland, with a lot of rest coming off a fantastic win against Kansas City, goes in. I think they win this game in Buffalo, which means with the points 2.5, and I think they'll win the game, take them with the points. Indianapolis goes into Cincinnati. Cincinnati's favored by 10.5 points. Cincinnati's up and down team. I think both of these regimes, both coaches are dead men walking, no offense to Chuck Pagano, but that's the term that we're going to use here. Cincinnati got obliterated by Pittsburgh again, 29-17 last week. Indianapolis played last week. I don't see the score. I think I missed that game totally. But both regimes are done. Both coaches should have a chance to go, and their teams are playing uninterested ball. That being said, Cincinnati has a chance to put themselves a little bit back into wild card contention with this game. I think Baltimore is right there. Pittsburgh is starting to become another contender of the AFC. I'll take with this points. I don't know, Cincy 10.5 against Indianapolis. I'll take Cincy with the points at home. The Chargers go back on the road, back to the East Coast to play the New England Patriots. The Chargers coming off a dominating win against the Denver Broncos at home, 21-0. But New England is starting to win these games, and they're keeping the opponent's scoring down off the scoreboard. New England's favored by 7 points in this game. The Chargers, they have a chance, though, to keep themselves afloat in the division and in the wild card race. I'm going to actually take the Chargers. I think their offense is a little bit better with the points, but New England to win. Houston goes into Seattle in a major test for their rookie, Deshaun Watson, at quarterback, who has been nothing short of spectacular, playing with the Houston Texans. They go into Seattle. Seattle last week destroyed the Giants at home 24-7. Their defense is starting to round into shape. It's always a tough place to play in Seattle. And I think they'll have sort of the answer to Deshaun Watson this week. They'll be able to get into his head. I'll take Seattle with the points, 5.5. Dallas goes into a much banged-up Washington Redskins team. Dallas coming off a dominating performance, albeit against the San Francisco 49ers. I think Dallas is favored by 2. I'm going to take the Skins in this game. I think the Skins are going to be competitive in this game. This is their main rival. Dallas is always everyone's main rival, but I think this is a game which in Washington. This is pretty much a battle, maybe not for the division, because it looks like the Eagles have it not sewn up. They're only 3-0 in the division. I'm taking a game by time, and we still have to play Dallas twice. But I think the Skins win this game against the Dallas Cowboys, who might be losing star running back Ezekiel Elliott after this game. Pittsburgh goes in Detroit. I was on the Detroit bandwagon for so long. I really was, but they are coming back down to earth a little bit, and Pittsburgh starting to show its dominance, especially defensively. I think they go into Detroit and they win this game by 3. And I think even though the Detroit is still a talented team, when the way they lost to New Orleans and the way they just get down every game so big and they have to rally back, you can't live like that. And the Pittsburgh defense can really shut Matthew Stafford down for 4 quarters. So look for Pittsburgh to cover. Denver goes into Kansas City. Denver's offense is in atrocious, only scoring 10 points against, you'd have to say, a mediocre Chargers team, scoring 0, and then at home against the Giants the week before, only scoring 10 against an atrocious Giants team. Kansas City's favored by 7. Kansas City lost Oakland last week. They lost in Pittsburgh. They're on a 2-game losing streak, but I think they can beat Denver at home. I think their defense can beat the Denver Broncos by 7 points. Remember, Alex Smith is the fantasy-wise has the most points in the league at his position at quarterback and maybe overall. But looking into that, I think that they can beat the Denver Broncos, who are putrid on offense, by at least 7 points, or probably more than 7 points. I could see that being an easy 24-10 game in Kansas City. So going down the picks, take Cleveland getting 9.5 against Minnesota in London. Only reason I'm taking there, the Browns. I think New Orleans will cover 9 points at home against Chicago. I think the Jets, who are receiving 4.5 points at home against a bad Atlanta team, they cover. I take Carolina on the road getting 2 points in Tampa Bay. Take the Eagles at home, favored by 13 over the Niners in what's supposed to be a rainstormy weather. Oakland getting 2.5 points in Buffalo. Take Oakland. Take Cincinnati, favored by 10.5. Take the Chargers on the road getting 7 points in New England. Take Seattle at home, favored by 5.5 over Houston. Take Washington at home, receiving 2 points. Take Pittsburgh on the road in Detroit, giving Detroit 3 points. Take the Steelers, and then take Kansas City at home, favored by 7 points. It's been the Matt Kwasaborski Show. I got to sort of focus my diatribes a little bit more. I go off on many, many tangents, but hopefully it challenges you in a way. Thank you to my loyal listeners. Thank you to Blog Talk Radio. And obviously, thanks, Al Gore, for inventing the internet. Remember, inspire the inspiration, everyone, and have a great weekend. Bye-bye.